he did a great job. Where's the kid that just spoke before me? He did a great job. I was listening, and I was thinking, I'm going to be sober 30 years, March 25th. Right? You know? Don't drink and don't die. And I mean that sincerely. I had cancer this year. And all I could think of was like, I'm not going to get the 30-year chip because I'm not going to be here. But I'm here. So I got sober at 27, though. And you can do the math. I'm going to be 58. And I walked into this meeting tonight, and I looked around, and I thought, wow, that is so great to get sober young, because you didn't spend all those years and all that waste and all that time screwing up, and then you have all those things you have to fix. Although, the girls in the bathroom told me that they can't drink coffee in rehab. I was like, oh my God, you know? I didn't go to rehab, but when I got sober, if you went to a meeting and you opened the door, if you didn't know better, you would have called the fire department because the smoke came out in like waves. And I remember when they stopped letting you smoke in meetings, it was like a big deal. It was like a big protest movement. And yeah, people were upset. And I remember cleaning ashtrays when I first got sober, and I smoked. I really commend you because I held on to my cigarettes for a long time. I was sober almost 10 years before I put them down. So I think that's very cool. I don't know about the coffee thing, though, you know? Like, I'm still doing the coffee thing. Some things don't change. Okay, you know, like, 30 years of sobriety is a really long time. And so I think in the first 5 to 10 years, I would talk about what happened to me, and I could feel it emotionally, because I think when you first come in, you're very close to that. Now I tell my story about my early life in sobriety, and it's like it happened to someone else. And I didn't think it was so important anymore until somebody said to me tonight when I walked in, I listen to people who have decades of sobriety, and they talk about feelings and things that happened to them, and I knew I was alcoholic because I could identify with that. So, I will tell you how I got here. I come by my alcoholism honestly. My father was an alcoholic, and his brother was an alcoholic, and my grandfather, who I never met, because I believe he sideswiped a car at age 70 and died. Probably it didn't say alcoholism in the paper, but I'm guessing that's probably what it was. He was an alcoholic. So I believe there's a genetic component to alcoholism, although I'm Irish and German, and that might have something to do with it. I don't know. Just saying. My father was an alcoholic, and I mention that because growing up in an alcoholic home, for those of us who did, you know that that is chaotic and crazy and upsetting and so forth. But I want to tell you that the greatest gift my father ever gave me was that he was an alcoholic. Because when I figured out that I was a real chip off the old block, I was like, not going there. I didn't have a lot of denial at that point, and I think God had a lot to do with that. But as a kid, I was shy. I was a people pleaser. I was a good student. I made my bed every morning. I walked the dog every day. You know, copied my homework 4 times so that it was perfect. You got the idea? And my dad, who had grown up in poverty in New York, worked his way up, and he actually was an executive for a Fortune 500 company in New York. So, alcoholics can be very, very focused people. And, of course, there was no welfare system, so it was like you either work or you starve, which is a great, it really helps with your work ethic. It really does. So he got a full scholarship to City College, and he went to work for Johnson & Johnson after that as a product manager, and they paid for his master's degree at NYU. So he was very successful. And I also mentioned that because I watched alcoholism take him out. And they didn't do drugs in those days, you know. Like, drinking was a big part when I was growing up. We had a bar in-house. Like, downstairs in the family room, like, we had a wet bar, you know, like, you picked it up and you went behind it and there was, you know, running water and all kinds of booze, and it was, partying was like 60s, 70s, my parents entertained, and alcohol was a big part of daily living. I don't know if that was just my house or that was the times. I don't know. I think it was the times as well, because people went out for two martini lunches and that was accepted at that time. I mean, Dean Martin was on TV and he was drunk, or supposedly he was drunk, you know, with the girls and everything, and people sort of accepted that. So drinking was a big deal. And I watched alcohol. I mean, I had a good life. You know, my father had a very good job, and so, I mean, I went to private schools and spent my summers at a yacht club, and life was really good. And it took it all. It was like watching the fall of the Roman Empire. It was not pretty. And everybody was ducking for cover, including me. And when I got to be about 13 or 14, he had really crossed the line. Like, he wasn't even, you couldn't deal with him anymore. And I would come home from school, and by this time there was no liquor cabinet. There was just one bottle of rat gut in the house, you know. And I would mix it with orange juice, and then I would fill it with water so nobody would know, because my mother was like marking the bottles. And I would go to sleep, because that's the way I would escape. And I couldn't deal with what was going on in my house, and that's what I did. And I did that even in sobriety, you know. Life got too much, I went to bed and pulled the covers over my head. So I guess I started drinking 13, 14, and then 15, 16, 17, I drank with the kids, you know, on Friday nights with the boyfriend, you know, kind of thing, group. Boone's Farm Apple Wine was very popular at the time. Beach parties, I lived on Long Island. Beach parties were a big thing. And I had tremendous tolerance. I thought I was never going to be an alcoholic because I could drink you under the table. When I wanted to go to college, of course, by that time, there was no money for college, okay? And I wanted to be a teacher. And I remember my father, he didn't like teachers. He thought, you know, those who can do, those who can't teach. And I was really crushed by that because I really wanted to be a teacher. They sent me to school to be a secretary. Really? Which I really hated. But you know, it was a living. I went to Katherine Gibbs in New York, which was a secretarial school, and I got a job in Manhattan. Actually, it was, if you wanted to be a secretary, it was a great job, because you could work anywhere. Uptown, downtown, east side, west side, didn't matter. You know, I worked for some really cool places. I worked for the lingerie buyer at JCPenney. That was a good job, because I was the sample size, and there was a sample room. And everybody wanted to get in to see the buyer. So they would bring me lots of presents, you know. And he was a drunk, too. I worked in advertising. I worked on Crest toothpaste and Charmin. You squeeze, don't, please don't squeeze the Charmin. I worked on that. on Third Avenue at a company called Benton and Bowles. We had 2 hours for lunch and half a day on Friday in the summer. And we drank at lunch. We drank at lunch, and that was, I mean, I wasn't alone drinking at lunch. We drank at lunch. We drank after work. We drank on the bar car on the Long Island Railroad on our way home. And sometimes we even drank in the morning at McCann's on our way uptown. But I had this tremendous tolerance, and I did not think that this was a problem. And everybody usually was really pretty drunk, and I was still standing. By this time, I was dating a New York City fireman, and man, could he drink. It was like 31st Street and 7th Avenue, and he drank bourbon. So I learned to drink bourbon. And I drank I.W. Harper in water, and I could drink a half a bottle of bourbon and walk away like it wasn't happening. So I didn't think I was an alcoholic. Although I can tell you that those feelings he talked about euphoria, you know, I was always frightened. Now, I don't know if that's because I grew up in an alcoholic home. It's pretty scary to grow up in an alcoholic home. It's sort of like a war zone, you know? But I was always frightened and always anxious. And when I drank, I wasn't frightened and I wasn't anxious and I could talk to you and I could dance and I was interesting, you know, at least I thought so. But my tolerance started to change, I guess, not long after that, 22, maybe 23. And by this time, alcohol made a lot of decisions for me. It made decisions about who I hung out with, and it also made a decision about who I married. So by this time, I was working for Arthur Anderson as a public accounting firm in New York. I worked for one of the partners, and we had 200 and some odd guys on staff from the best schools in the country, so I thought that it might be a good time to get married. Right? I went husband shopping. I'm not stupid, right? You didn't make enough money as a secretary. And I wanted to go to college, but alcoholism, I couldn't understand how I could possibly go to college at night or on the weekends and keep up my lifestyle of drinking, right? So that didn't seem like a good idea. I thought marriage was like the easier, softer way. So if you think it's the easier, softer way, I'm telling you, it's not. Don't make that mistake. But I did. And I was dating a couple of people. Like, in those days, you didn't sleep with people. Like, you just went on dates with people. You didn't go to bed with them. And so you could date, like, 3, 4, 5 guys at a time. It was okay. So I was having a very good time. And one of the guys that I was dating, he was a really nice guy. And when it came down to it, I chose not to marry him. I married my ex-husband, obviously. And I remember the partner saying to me, "Why are you going to marry Mark and not Brian?" And because Brian was going to be a partner, and Brian, you know, Brian was definitely the better choice. And I was going to marry Mark because Mark drank like I did. And Mark's dad was an alcoholic. And I didn't feel less than when I went home to visit his parents. And by that time, I was already carrying the shame of my alcoholic family and the feelings of insecurity about myself. And so I didn't feel that I was worthy of marrying the other guy. The other guy was very confused, by the way. He couldn't figure out what happened. But I realized, looking back now, that that's what happened. I knew that I was an alcoholic at that point. I knew that my family, my father was an alcoholic. I had nothing to put on the table. And so I chose, and I married Mark. And Mark was, he was okay. He was, it was more of a business deal than it was a marriage. The partner was leaving, and he was going into business for himself. He offered me a job and a big raise to go with him and leave and go to Connecticut. And everybody wanted to go with him. He was only taking a couple of people. And at first I said no, because I was afraid of everything. I didn't think. When I first went to work in Manhattan, I was afraid of riding the subway. I was afraid I missed the train. I was afraid of everything. And by the time it was 3-4 years later, I'd been working in Manhattan, I was riding the 8th Avenue at 2 in the morning, which is not a good idea. Anyway, I said, okay, and I was going to go to Connecticut and get off the Long Island Railroad, and Stan was going to do tax shelter work for people who make millions of dollars. You know, the 1% people you talk about? Well, he did tax shelter work for them. And so I was dating Mark, and I came home, and I said, I'm going to go move to Connecticut. And he said, well, I'll go with you. And I said, well, you can't do that because we're not married. Because that was those times, and you didn't do that. You didn't live with people you weren't married to. And he said, well, that's okay. We'll get married. So I said, okay. Like I said, it was a business deal. So I got married and moved to Connecticut. And I kept drinking. And only now, it looked really good. I lived in this place called Ridgefield, Connecticut, and if you've never been to Ridgefield, Connecticut, it looks like somebody made it up. You know, it looks like a Thomas Kinkade painting, and everybody has blonde hair and blue eyes, right? They were wearing Eyes Are shirts at the time. Very low key. I came from Long Island. Long Island is flashy. Connecticut is not. Connecticut is very low key. And they drove Mercedes. It was very quiet. Everybody wore L.L. Bean. It's the truth. But I kept drinking. And I used to think I drank too much, and I was angry. Oh, yeah. When I drank, I was not a nice drunk. Because all that stuff from when I grew up was all in here. And if you poured enough alcohol on it, it came out. And I was argumentative, and I was nasty, and opinionated. And actually, those qualities took a lot of years to fix. But I wasn't nice at all. And I blamed it, and I was always unhappy. That was it. I was always unhappy. And before I got married, I used to think, well, if you had my childhood, you'd be unhappy too. And then I got married, and I was living in this beautiful, picturesque town. And I was married to this young executive, and he was really nice looking, and he was making a good living, and life was really good. I was playing tennis on weekends, and he was an auditor, and so he traveled around the country for Union Carbide. It was a chemical company before it blew up a place in India called Bhopal. But, I mean, I went all these places. My life was really good, and I was still unhappy. And it occurred to me that maybe it had something to do with me. And I was still drinking, but I figured that one out. So I did a logical thing. I didn't stop drinking. I went to therapy because I had good insurance. And the guy was in Ridgefield. And I went to this beautiful building it was like fireplaces, one of these old mansions they turned into a medical building. And I told this guy the story of my life, and he just wrote everything down. Never asked me about my drinking, right? Never asked. At least I don't remember that he asked. But I didn't get any better. Well, Stan decided that he was not going to have the offices in White Plains anymore. He was going back to the city because he was getting a divorce. And so I started commuting from Ridgefield, Connecticut to Wall Street. That was nuts. It was like 2 hours one way. But I was making a lot of money, and I didn't have a college degree. And my husband thought money was a good idea. He was from Buffalo. He was from Cheektowaga in Buffalo, which is like not the greatest place. He lived in a house where the planes flew over the house and the house shook. So he was absolutely convinced that money was the answer in life. And so I was making a lot of money, and when I said, I'm not going to Wall Street anymore, he was like, but I said, I'm not going to Wall Street anymore. So where I lived in Danbury, Connecticut, the only corporate headquarters really there at the time was Union Carbide. And so I went down to Stanford, and I got myself a job for Cadbury Schweppes candy company. And I worked there for a while, but I really hated it. And I was used to not being a secretary anymore. When I worked for Stan, I did trading, and it was a lot more fun. But I still didn't figure out that I needed to go to college. I did start going to college, actually, and I went to a class on Saturday morning. It was a marketing class that I needed. And I used to go so hungover all the time. And I know that that professor looked at me like, oh my God, you know, I know he did. And I got to the course and I aced the course, but you know what? Alcohol was still making decisions. So finally, I took a job selling cars. I didn't know anything about cars. Nothing. I came home, told my husband it was something with a C. Chevy? It was Chrysler. But I learned to sell cars, and that job got me sober. Everybody drank in the car business. If you're in the car business, I'm really sorry, but we did. We drank in the showroom after Saturdays. And my husband was traveling, and he was on a month's audit, and I was married. By this time, I was married, I don't know, 7-8 years. And I think I stayed married because he was always traveling. No kidding. Like, he was either coming or going. So there wasn't really that much time to have an argument. because he wasn't home that much. And I went out drinking, which I'd never do. I never drank in bars. I never did that. But I don't know. I went out with a group of friends, and I came out of a blackout. Oh, by the way, I blacked out all the time. And I thought everybody who drank blacked out. I thought that was like everybody did that. I only found out in AA that that was a sure sign of alcoholism. Anyway, I came out of a blackout on the dance floor with somebody I didn't know. And I thought, oh, this isn't good. So I drove home. And I don't remember driving home. I drove home a brand new car because I was in the car business. I don't remember driving it home, but the next day was Saturday. And in the car business, you don't call in sick on Saturday. If you're dead, okay. But not sick. So I woke up, and it was like 6 o'clock, 6:30, and I was still drunk from the night before. And I still had my clothes on. And I tried to get out of bed. I wasn't doing too well. And there was a mirror on the sliding doors for the closet. And I was actually laying on the floor, and I picked up my face, and I looked in the mirror, and I realized that you're just like your father. It was like, wow. That was my time is up. So I picked myself up, and I got in the shower, and that was the last time I've ever had a drink. That was March 25th, 1985. Now, I wish I could tell you that in sobriety I did everything right, made all the right decisions, and I lived happily ever after. But that would not be true. But I will tell you this, that I got sober, that I developed a relationship with God, that when my marriage fell apart, I didn't fall apart, and I didn't drink. And I did put myself through college, and I am a teacher. And I actually still talk to my ex-husband. And I'm really glad I'm not married to him anymore. And life is good. Life is good. I am the person God meant me to be today because Alcoholics Anonymous helped me to get sober, helped me to learn how to live. Help me to take responsibility for my life. Help me to take responsibility for my behavior. And help me to grow. Because if you're drinking, you have a problem, you cause a mess, and then you drink. So you never have to face your mess. When you get sober, you're not drinking, you make a mess. It happens. You make a bad decision. It happens. It happens to everybody. Whatever that bad decision might be. But it's fixable. And you learn from those mistakes. What do you know? And you try to not make them again. And you have pain, and you don't drink. And when you have pain, and you don't drink, you become compassionate for other people. And you learn what it is. You become human, you know? You're not bulletproof anymore, like when you're drinking. So, I got sober, I got divorced, I bought myself a new little condo for myself, I had a relationship in AA, which happens, and was good. It was good. I learned to ski, I went to Vermont, I went hiking, we had dogs, it was good. It wasn't meant to be forever, and that's okay. I got support when I needed it. I had a sponsor who helped me understand God. And I turn my life over to God every single morning. I tell him, I'm going to try and stay out of your way. I'm going to try and not manage anybody else's life. I'm a teacher. That's really hard. That was one of the hard things I had to learn in AA, is that I thought that, you know, the way I saw things was the only way to see things. And that, you know, you should do it my way, black and white. And life is not like that. So it has been a process. But I can't. Oh, I got to Florida. I was supposed to get married again, and I bailed. That was a good decision. Florida has been good to me. I've not been as nice to Florida as Florida has been to me. That's the truth. I'm from New England. I like it when it's cold. I'm not so happy when it's hot. But God has a sense of humor, because about 3 years ago, I came down with rheumatoid arthritis. So you don't want to have rheumatoid arthritis up north. And like I said, Florida's been good to me. I bought a home here, a townhouse that was brand new, that where I come from would have been $500,000. I mean, no way. And I have a network of people, you know, from AA. That's a great thing about AA. You know, you can go anywhere in the country. I remember thinking about possibly going to North Carolina at one point, and people go, somebody said to me, wasn't in AA, how can you think about moving any place in the country, you know, by yourself? Why not? Well, what are you going to do when you get there? But see, we have AA. And when we walk into an AA room, then you have friends, and then you know people, right? So, but I'm still here, and I have people I can call. You know, when you're a single woman and you have a house, you need people who hang shelves, and, you know, otherwise you got to get a husband. It's much better this way. You know people. You know, guys in AA, you can say, listen, you know, you want to earn some extra money, come on over, hang the drapes, do this, do that, do that. It's great. It's fabulous. People who fix cars, you know. And people to call when you're having a hard time. I had cancer this year. That wasn't fun. That was really scary. Really scary. The scariest part about being sick is that maybe I can't work and take care of myself. They don't tell you about that part. It's like, maybe I can't work and take care of myself. Now what? But the thing is, if I look back over my life, God has taken care of me all these years. I have everything I need. I have a really good life. And I just put one foot in front of the other. You know, I could tell you all these times that it looked like it wasn't going to work out, and God came through. Lots of miracles. Lots of them. That really, I couldn't figure it out if I wanted to. So now I stop trying to figure it out. I don't try and figure it out anymore. I just try and do the next right thing every day. Swear. That's it. And I really leave it to Him. I do. Teaching in Florida could make you crazy. Where I come from, it's a wonderful job. God forgive me. Teaching children is a wonderful job. Teaching in Florida is not wonderful. It's a nightmare of tests and data, and it's crazy, ridiculous. But it's okay. It's okay. Every year, it works out. The kids do great. I'm still here. I don't always do things the way they want me to do them. I shut the door and do what I have to do. You know? I have 15 ADD kids in my class. I do what I have to do. Yeah, I know. My boss says, I don't know why. I said, Brian, I know you have a lot of faith, but 15 in one class? Really? But he doesn't give me the hoodlums, which is good, because I don't do hoodlums. Anyway, I'm a good teacher. I love what I do. That's a gift. That's a gift. I love what I do. That was the best thing I ever did. And I wouldn't have done that if I was drinking, because I wouldn't have had the courage to do it. I have a dog. I have a Labrador Retriever. And I also have a standard poodle who somebody left on my doorstep. Up until 4 years ago, I taught aerobics every morning at 6 o'clock. It's been a tough couple of years, drugs and steroids and cancer. So my wish for 2015 is like to get a grip and get back to the gym and see if I can, like, get my life back together. But without AA, I wouldn't have a prayer of anything. But because I'm sober, there's always hope for tomorrow. So, thank you for listening.